We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovix. Joining me today is Simon Hunt. He's a consultant in the global economy, China, and the copper industry. Simon, thanks for joining me today.
My pleasure, even though it's 6 o'clock in the morning.
Absolutely. Early morning for you, late in the evening for me, but I'm very grateful that you can make the time and that we have the ability to make this work from two very different parts of the world here. So, Simon, you and I have spoken of war in the past, and you have been very accurate over the years in kind of telegraphing where the world has been headed. I think with this backdrop of conflict, it lays out much of how you see the consequences for much else in the world, whether that be the markets, you know, copper prices, gold prices, what have you. So with the two main conflicts in the Middle East and in Eastern Europe seemingly to only be escalating, do you see a continuation of these escalations at this time?
Unfortunately, I think it is inevitable that they will escalate. If we start in Europe, it's quite clear that NATO's fight with Russia in the Ukraine has now extended to terrorist attacks directly into Russia. And in fact, it was not so long ago that the head of Kiev's intelligence services actually said, we are going deeper and deeper into Russia. So Russia will retaliate. How it will retaliate, nobody knows. It may not be conventionally. It could be with a cyber attack. It could be with an ETP attack, or it could be with a missile directed at a specific place. But a retaliation will definitely come. Then you go to the Middle East, and Israel's bombing of the Iranian consulate is effectively, under international law, an attack on Iran. How will Iran respond? I think it's very likely that their response will be coordinated with Russia, so that they will, two countries will respond jointly and simultaneously. That may not happen soon, because the longer that Iran delays any retaliation, the greater pressure is placed on Israel, because they have to remain in a crisis mode. What's interesting is that, except for one brigade, Israel has relocated the bulk of its military forces to the northern border in preparation for launching an attack on Hezbollah. And of course, Hezbollah is located both in Lebanon and in Syria. So whatever peace deal is devised, if there is one, over Gaza, a ceasefire in exchange for prisoners being released, hostages being released, the real war will be starting once Israel formally launches a full-scale attack on Lebanon. Because what you have is Hamas is not an organized military force. It's a terrorist organization. Hezbollah, on the other hand, is a very formidable military force backed by a very large stockpile of cruise and ballistic missiles and drones, of course. So the prospects of the war escalating, I think, are very real. And once the escalation does start, it is then, I think, that markets will wake up to how dangerous this world is. And the complacency now being seen in global equity markets will be replaced by a shock and a sharp correction, maybe as much as 30 to 40%. So if I then extend that further, if that does happen, and I think it'll happen before mid-year, then you'll have a big reaction on base metal prices, including copper. Because at the moment, it is not the trade that is pushing prices higher, it's the funds. And most of those funds are actually Chinese funds.
Spiking demand for copper?
Sorry?
Spiking demand for copper?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think the Chinese funds were basically pushing prices up in order to push up the asset value, the prices of the Chinese copper equities like Jiangxi Copper, which have, from memory, have risen by 50% since the start of the year.
So, Simon, you had mentioned Syria there at one point. Is there a possibility of the war in the Middle East spreading to implicate Russia in another front?
I think it's very likely. There is a treaty between Russia and Syria. And if Israel launches a full-scale attack on Syria, and they've already been bombing all around Damascus, the airfields, et cetera, et cetera, then there's a real risk that Russia comes in to support Syria.
Because of that alliance?
But I think, as I said before, I think these moves will be very measured and thought out by both Russia and China and Iran. Mm-hmm.
Do you think that NATO is in some ways trying to provoke Russia?
America is certainly trying to provoke both Russia and Iran. But they are fully aware of what Washington is trying to do. And that's why they're being very measured. And I think that it is only when they have 100% proof that the intelligence services of America and the UK were involved in orchestrating the attack on the concert hall in Moscow. It's only when they have that 100% proof will they then retaliate. Iran already has it that it was Israel that bombed the consulate.
So, Simon, you laid out in a recent letter that you're expecting this shock that will cause a sharp correction in equity and base metal markets by mid-year. You mentioned that, you know, this escalation of war is one of the possible, let's say, catalysts for this shock. What are the other ones that you laid out?
I think the biggest one is that actually economic activity in America is not what it is being pushed up to be by the media and the brokers. If you look at gross domestic investment, which should correspond to GDP, It rose by only 0.5% last year, compared to GDP's increase of 2.5%. The latest NFIB small business survey was downright bearish, weak. And if you do the real numbering on unemployment or employment, employment is nowhere near as strong as it's being made out to be. If you look at the household survey, I think we've had a drop of something from memory like year on year, 800,000 people. And the bulk of virtually all of the reported increase in employment are part-time jobs. Part-time jobs pay less. So I think the point will come again before mid-year when the markets will wake up to the fact that business in America is actually either in recession or on the verge of recession. And it's only then that the Fed will cut rates. And in Europe, there are pockets of better growth, but overall, Europe is in recession. And if we're right on inflation, inflation is not only just being sticky, it's also increasing and will continue to increase, driven by energy prices and food prices. It was very interesting that only a few days ago, Larry Summers and his team remodeled CPI before Arthur Burns in the 70s started meddling with the numbers. And he came up with a peak CPI last year of 18%, 1.8. John Williams of Shadow Government Statistics has been measuring religiously all the CPI and employment data before Arthur Burns started fiddling with them. And he has an average CPI of 12% for last year. 12% corresponds very closely to what another study, the Chatwood Survey, which is done twice a year. They haven't completed the second half of last year yet, but for the first half, it averaged over 10%. This is the inflation that 80% of American households are feeling the pinch of. Mm-hmm. So really no wonder that, again, when you adjust retail sales for even the published CPI figure, you are experiencing falling retail sales. But if you then adjust for what the real inflation is, it's pretty horrific. So those are two shocks. The third shock is all is not well within the undergrowth of the financial system. And we could well see a major bankruptcy and problems with some of the regional banks emerging before the middle of the year. So you add all those together, and yes, the prospect of a serious correction in equity markets is very real, which of course would then shake out a lot of the financial market bulls in copper and other base metals. For some time, we've had a scenario, correction by mid-year, correction leads to the Fed and other central banks dropping interest rates, flooding the system of liquidity, leads to an inflationary takeoff. But the inflationary takeoff, with probably global inflation over 15%, and US inflation well over 10%, will then mean that the US 10-year treasury, the bond vigilantes will hate this and will push long rates up into double-digit figures, which then causes the crash to occur. Mm-hmm. If what I'm hearing is a different interpretation, which is that the dollar will be supported, but the treasury market will be allowed to fall to its own level. So that means interest rates remaining much higher for much longer. And it would put the pressure on countries outside the USA, thus all part of the neocons' policy of retaining Americans' hegemony and dollar domination of currencies. So, if this scenario plays out, we have the crash this year. What does that do for an election? Will there be an election under that circumstances? Do we have a war instead? I mean, these are part of the known unknowns.
It really seems like there's just almost an infinite number of tripwires to send us into absolute catastrophe here. And, you know, Simon, I really appreciate your, you know, really 50,000 foot view in being able to help kind of explain these to us and understand how they all fit together.
Well, I think you put it very well when you said there are so many tripwires. It's exactly right.
Yeah, it seems like they're in a lot of ways, there's no way out of the mess that we're finding ourselves in here. And it could end or unravel, you know, many, many different ways here. But I wanted to go back to something that you were saying about the banking industry. You used the word in the undergrowth of the banking industry. Is that in the US or in Europe?
I think it's everywhere. You've got a highly leveraged system. Mm-hmm. It takes time for the rise in rates to impact the fruit higher up the tree. All we've seen so far is the low-hanging fruit, mm-hmm. but the big fruit is higher up. So I think that's what we'll start seeing between now and mid-year. It fits the historical timing. Mm-hmm. Between when rates rise and when they actually do impact the big fruit.
So, Simon, what kinds of capital shifts around the globe could we expect as a consequence of this global shock?
Well, we're seeing it already. A rush out of, particularly out of Europe into America. One of the reasons why equity markets have been so strong. But I keep coming back. How are Russia and China and other countries, both within and outside the BRICS group of nations, go react. And I think the day is not too far off, certainly within 2 years, when China will announce that its currency is supported by the gold that its citizens hold, which probably amounts to something in excess of 23,000 tons, as being bought off the Shanghai Gold Exchange since it was formed in 2002.
And that's just the privately held gold?
That's just the privately held gold, whether by institutions or households. And what the PBOC has set up just a couple of months ago is a system whereby households, through their bank accounts, can purchase physical gold directly from the Shanghai Gold Exchange. It goes even further than that. They can do it on an installment basis. And then if you look at the various videos of Chinese shoppers buying gold jewelry, huge lines, and even there is a new 1 ounce little nugget of gold which is being sold. So where is the gold has shifted from the west to the east, it will carry on doing so. What is that going to do to the bullion dealers, etc., who've basically run short positions?
The bullion dealers in the West?
The bullion dealers in the West. So I think that the more you look at it, the gold is coming back into the monetary system because neither Russia nor China, probably nor any of the other BRICS countries, want to evolve their currencies into fiat currencies. So one way is through the gold route, and I think that's what's happening.
So I believe that you explained that in one of your other letters as, let's say, the first step that China could bring gold back into the monetary system, right?
Correct.
So what is the, let's say, the second step to them bringing gold back into the monetary system?
That is, and I think that is a few years ahead, because the practical difficulties of creating a currency fully backed by gold, i.e. convertible, that's what BRICS will develop. I suspect that the pace of change will increase this year because Russia assumes the chairmanship of BRICS. And many of their senior policy advisors, Putin's policy advisors, want to see a currency that is backed by physical things like gold and commodities. I think we can extend this idea even further. It's inevitable that more countries want to join BRICS. And the probability is that many of the commodity-producing countries want to join BRICS. so that in 2 to 3 years' time, a large percentage of the world's energy and base metal producers will be members of BRICS. Then you can well see a situation where they control a large percentage of base metals and energy, and will then say, we're not prepared to sell our product for dollars. Because if you do the math, it's pretty clear that the profits that they have made have really been illusionary, because the value of the dollar at $1980 is now worth 25 cents. So where's the real profit? So I think before we get there, we will have to have this huge global economic and geopolitical crisis. And it's only in a crisis like that that you will see a restructuring of the global system. So I think by the end of this decade to sometime in the early 2030s, a new global system and structure will emerge.
Simon, how does that system of a gold-backed currency start? Or let's say China and Russia, or you know, any of these other trading partners within the BRICS using gold for the basis of trade with other countries?
Well, I think the system that is emerging now, mm-hmm. whether it is between Russia and China, or India and Russia, or even Saudi Arabia and China, or the UAE in China, is that you have trade differential accounts. One country has a surplus to the other. And those surpluses are held in a gold differential account. So Russia has a surplus with China. I've forgotten the figure. The difference is held in a gold differential account. So you don't need dollars. Gold is the intermediary between the surpluses and deficits between countries. I mean, if you look at how China's exports to the UAE and Saudi Arabia are increasing, it's only going to be in a few years that instead of those two countries having surpluses with China, that China has surpluses with them. So again, you need something in between. You don't need the dollar. So they all like gold. They all have gold. So it's held through a gold differential account.
How could that system in turn end up influencing, let's say, US dollar expectations and US Treasury interest rates over time?
Well, it comes back to the issue I raised earlier, which does the policy change from supporting the treasury market to supporting the dollar? This is another unknown. Otherwise, if they continue with the current policy, then you're going to see a very sharp fall in the value of the US dollar, with the index probably by the early 2030s halving in value. But if they change the policy to supporting the dollar and allowing the treasury market to fall, that's when the real battle will occur. And that battle is one that could well lead to war, mm-hmm. which is a very likely prospect within a few years.
Simon, we've spoken before about the rise of the BRICS nations as a trading power. I've had a recent conversation about a gentleman that wrote a book based on demographics, and he painted this very grim picture for the future growth of China and, you know, many of these Eastern Bloc countries. So do you think that China specifically and these other countries be suffering from this demographics problem? And if we throw in a war in that as well, that seems like added pressure for, you know, productive members of that society if they're facing this type of issue.
I did a big report on the future of China mm-hmm. over the weekend.
So it must be fresh in your mind.
The actual demographics of China are not as bad as being painted by a lot of people. For instance, by 2040, the total population will only fall by 12 million compared to 2022. What is quite stunning is when you look at households' gross income and savings. So just to paraphrase, in 2022, China's gross household income was around double Japan's entire GDP. Its savings were the same as France's entire GDP. And the country's household income in 2040 will be about the same as the country's GDP was in 2022. Does that spell a weak economy? And then the IMF, in a report that they issued last year based on 2017 data, which was the last of the full data that they needed, they concluded that China had a net surplus of $140 trillion. Where would you like to invest long term?
Well,
is this where the big money, the big long term capital is going to flow to?
I think one of the interesting anecdotes that we can use as an example there is their ability to manufacture. You know, you gave the example of how their manufacturing base compares to that of the US when we're talking about arms during wartime, right?
Well, this is the big issue. China's ability to manufacture high quality goods at cheap prices has nothing to do with currencies. It's because they have these highly efficient and deep-seated supply chains and their own ability, plus plants are fully automated, much more so than anywhere else in the world. In fact, from memory, the number of robotics in use in China are greater than the G7 countries, including America. So, and again, numbers from the top of my head. A low-priced EV in America costs something like $37,000, compared to China's $9,500. China produces nuclear power at a cost of $2 billion per gigawatt. The new plant in, I think it's in Arizona, produces nuclear at a price of $11.5 to $12 billion per gigawatt. So, okay, you can impose sanctions, you can impose tariffs, but they'd have to be absolutely astronomical to make any difference. So this is a great worry for G7 countries, because fundamentally, China, it's cheaper to produce goods, and China has the ability also of creating infrastructure, whether inside China or overseas, on time, cheaper, and faster than anybody else. This is the fundamental equation. Mm-hmm. And part of it, of course, is China has a huge domestic market. So you add up huge domestic market plus automation plus deep-seated efficient supply chains, and you have the answer. Mm-hmm.
Well, even just from an energy standpoint, if your electricity is 6 times more expensive, that's going to make you extremely, it's going to make it extremely absolutely. Difficult to compete with that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So where do you think that difference, you know, using the nuclear plant example, where do you think that difference comes in? Is it because a lot of the plants in the West are custom built, custom engineered, one-off plants? And I've heard that a lot of the Chinese ones are, you know, in some ways just a cookie cutter plant so that they can build it and get it running. Is that where a lot of it comes from? Just this
I think it's also efficiency? Technology. I'm not an expert in this, but China has been using the latest, most modern technology. And it's their ability to produce infrastructure on time. It's superb planning. I mean, I was involved in the purely as an observer, in the construction of a large private sector Chinese copper smelter some years ago. And I was in the meetings with the group that was actually building the smelter. I mean, it was remarkable just listening to how they went about it. So there's something fundamentally wrong with the West's structure.
I think we could point to, let's say, overregulation in one of those respects, probably, right?
Yeah, sure.
You know, Simon, we heard a lot about their real estate and their debt issues. Have they been able to overcome those, you know, laggards on their economy by pushing manufacturing more or focusing manufacturing?
I think you need to take a step back. President Xi decided early on when he became president that too much of China's investment was going into real estate, and a lot of it was speculative. That people were buying more than one. I forget the figure, something like 20% of households had more than one property. There was this relationship, almost incestuous, between the real estate developers and the local governments, because the local governments, a lot of their revenue came from land sales. So he made a conscious decision to stop this speculative investment and to switch it into the productive side of the economy. And I don't have a chart to show you, but if you looked at a chart between real estate investment and manufacturing, real estate goes down like that, and manufacturing goes up like that. So what you're now seeing is China's surpluses from manufacturing far exceeding any other country. So the decision was taken. Real estate, going back to what she has always said, is houses are for living in. And that investment, that surplus investment that went into real estate, is now going into manufacturing. Mm-hmm. Manufacturing is the future driving force of China's economy. And it's going to take a long time for consumption as a percentage of GDP to catch up with manufacturing.
Simon, I pulled a quote out of one of your pieces of writing here, and it said that fundamental long-term money is selling. Short-term spec funds are chasing rainbows, but rainbows never light up the skies for long. I thought that was just a...
Did I write that?
Well, it was, at least it was in your report. But I thought it was an excellent way to put this current situation. So what are they selling, and what do you think they are turning to? Because I'm sure it's not just cash positions that they're trying to build.
You mean the long-term capital?
Yes.
I think it's goods. It's things. People don't want cash. Let's rephrase that. The long-term investors, big old families, what are they switching into? They're switching into land, real estate, physical things, gold, anything other than paper. It's a switch from paper, which has driven global markets for, 40-odd years, into physical things. So it's the short-term guys that are chasing the rainbows. Mm-hmm. But the rainbows don't last for long.
Simon,
rather like what you had on Monday night.
Which was what? Oh, the eclipse?
Yeah.
Well, thankfully we all lived through that. So
yeah.
Simon, is Europe in much of the same boat as the US is in regards to recession and these financial headwinds? Are they on a very similar path?
No, I think they're in the worst position. If you take Germany, Germany's industry has been built on cheap energy from Russia. They no longer have that. The debt issue within corporations and actually within the central banks is, of individual countries is pretty awful. So I think Europe is in a worse position than America. The only way that, well, you have a dichotomy of views between the political class and the industrial class. The political class wants nothing to do with Russia and China because they have essentially been bought by Washington or bought by the Davos crowd. Whereas industry had always had very successful investments in Russia and in China and want to pursue those. Mm-hmm. So this is the big dichotomy. How is it going to be resolved? And it comes back to what we've been saying all along. It's only war that's going to resolve it. Mm-hmm. The age of diplomacy seems to be thrown out of the window.
Almost seems like a forgotten art at this point.
Well, completely forgotten. Though I think Russia and China still have it, but it's been a forgotten art in Washington. Mm-hmm. Instead of diplomacy, they say, if you don't do what we tell you to do, we will come and invade you.
Simon, getting back to, you know, this global shock that, you know, has a couple of potential catalysts. What would the central bank's reaction to this crisis be, whether that be in the U.S. or the ECB?
The reaction has to be we're going to flood the system with liquidity and we're going to drop interest rates. Mm-hmm. That's been our thesis all along. But as I said earlier, I'm just wondering whether the Fed and the Treasury won't follow that script, in that the policy will be to support the dollar and allow the Treasury market to find its own feet. Mm-hmm. I've not been able to answer that question yet.
Well, of course, I'm sure that will take time to reveal itself, which group ends up being the stronger within Washington. But, yeah, you know, if we do get this flood of liquidity, you know, we really haven't seen these inflation targets get back down to where they want them to be. So was the inflation problem ever actually even close to being solved? Especially, you know, considering this, especially considering the more realistic numbers that I think everybody actually feels a lot more rather than the reported numbers.
The only way we get back to the inflation numbers that the central banks want, whether it be 2% or 3%, is in a deep recession.
So if the central banks take this route of flooding the system with liquidity, won't that mean another great inflationary impulse for the global
economy? Oh, absolutely. It comes back to our original scenario, mm-hmm. which is that we have, between the middle of this year and the middle of, say, 2025, the huge inflationary takeoff, whereby food prices will be rising sharply, energy prices will be rising sharply, wages will be rising, global inflation will be 15% plus, US inflation over 10%. That all seems hunky-dory. You will have a huge takeoff in all base metal prices, Gold will, of course, don't ask me what number, significantly higher than today. And that'll all seem fine, except for the bond vigilantes will hate what's going on. And you'll see 10-year treasuries, as an example, going to over 10%. When that happens, what happens to a highly leveraged, not only US, but global system? It crashes. That's when you would get probably at the best a series of rolling recessions, but more likely depression. And that will coincide with internal conflicts within countries and the risk of global war. As you come back to America wanting to defend its hegemony and the domination of the US dollar, and China and Russia saying, no, it's the wrong way forward. We don't want a world that is unipolar in nature. We want a multipolar world. So one party has to give. And the way the system is set up at the moment, we will have war. The hope is that somebody comes into the White House, whoever it might be, and that is if there is an election, who will say, this is all stupid. We should go back to the art of diplomacy. But that's an unknown.
As you said in your last letter there, there are known knowns, there are known unknowns, and there are just unknowns. And unfortunately, there are...
That's an unknown.
There are too many of those unknowns at this
point. Yeah. So really, the only... what I think we can be pretty sure about is that we have this big correction in global equity markets and in base metal markets by mid-year. What follows thereafter depends on decisions that Washington take. Do we defend the dollar or do we defend our treasury market?
Mm-hmm. And that's the known knowns that we have at this point, right?
Yes. Another one. Mm-hmm.
Well, Simon, I think that's a reasonable place to kind of wrap things up for today. Is there anything that you'd like to leave our audience with before we do?
Hey, anybody wants to contact me, my website is simon-hunt.com. Mm-hmm. And basically, my message is it's a time for caution, not a time to take speculative positions.
Well, I definitely think, you know, after giving this another two or three listens, I think that all of these warnings definitely warrant some caution.
Yeah.
Excellent, Simon. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me.
Always a pleasure.
Time for breakfast now.
Excellent.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.